I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. New York, this is Democracy Now!
These missiles can follow multiple targets, accept commands when they are launched, and change their target along the way.
Thousands of U.S. Marines and sailors have been deployed to the Middle East in an effort to deter Iran from seizing oil tankers in what the Washington Post calls a remarkable escalation in tensions between the two countries. Iran's responded by equipping its navy with drones and missiles. We'll speak with the Quincy Institute's Trita Parsi, who asks, with Marines on Persian Gulf vessels, is Biden risking war with Iran? Then an update on the U.S. response to asylum seekers, starting at the southern border in Texas, where state troopers are reportedly separating migrant families, to New York City, where there are growing calls for long-term shelter for immigrants as the city claims it's run out of room.
It's kind of another slap in the face to our, you know, historical New Yorkers who've been here and our most recent arrivals who are just seeking a little bit of help in this moment. We need to actually stop doubling and tripling down on broken systems like our emergency shelter system and actually invest in getting people out of emergency shelter and into permanent housing.
Then the Iraqi men suing U.S. military contractor Khaki for torture they endured at Abu Ghraib prison may finally get their day in court. We'll speak with their lawyer and hear from one of the men, an Al Jazeera reporter, about what they endured.
One of these methods was that you were kept naked, handcuffed, the hood on your head. Then they would bring a big dog. You hear the panting and barking of the dog very close to your face. This is one of the methods of torture and interrogation that they conducted.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. West African leaders are planning to hold an emergency summit Thursday to discuss Niger following last week's military coup. ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, had threatened to use military force if Niger's military leaders did not step down by Sunday, but there has been deep division within ECOWAS over how to respond after the deadline was ignored. The Senate in Nigeria has come out against the use of force, even though Nigeria is the largest and most powerful nation in ECOWAS. On Monday, the United States announced it was freezing about $100 million in aid to Niger, where the U.S. maintains a major drone base. Meanwhile, Acting Deputy Secretary of State Victoria Nuland traveled to Niger, where she met with some leaders of the coup who rejected her calls to step down. Nuland was denied a chance to meet with Niger's ousted President Mohamed Bazoum. Meanwhile, Mali and Burkina Faso have sent delegations to Niger to reaffirm support for Niger's new rulers. All three nations are former French colonies where anti-colonial sentiment has soared in recent years. This is a spokesperson from the government in Mali.
I would like to remind you that Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger have been dealing for over 10 years with the negative socioeconomic, security, political, and humanitarian consequences of NATO's hazardous adventure in Libya. Of course, we ask ourselves, if it took us 10 years, how many years would it take us to get over another adventure of the same nature in Niger? We don't know. 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years. One thing is certain. President Goïta and President Traoré have clearly said no, no, and no. We will not accept military intervention in Niger. They are coming for our survival.
In Ukraine, at least seven people have died in the eastern city of Pokrovsk in a pair of Russian missile strikes on an apartment block and a hotel regularly used by journalists covering the war. The first strike hit at 7:15 p.m. Monday. A second strike came 40 minutes later, hitting first responders who'd raced to the scene of the initial strike. According to Ukrainian officials, 31 people were wounded, including 19 police officers and five rescuers. In other news from Ukraine, authorities have detained a woman accused of plotting to assassinate Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. The woman has not been identified. Voters in Ohio are heading to the polls today for a special election to decide whether to make it harder to amend Ohio's state constitution by raising the threshold from a simple majority to 60% of the vote. Republicans in Ohio introduced the ballot measure just months before voters will decide in November whether to enshrine abortion rights in Ohio's constitution. The Republican mega donor, Richard Uihlein of Illinois, a key backer of anti-abortion groups, has bankrolled the Republican effort by giving $4 million to the group Protect Our Constitution. Former Minneapolis police officer Tu Tao has been sentenced to nearly 5 years in prison on state charges for his role in the police murder of George Floyd in May 2020. Tao held the crowd back while Officer Derek Chauvin pinned George Floyd to the ground with a knee on his neck for over 9 minutes. Tao is already serving a 42-month federal prison sentence for violating Floyd's federal civil rights. Donald Trump has suffered another legal setback. A federal judge has dismissed a defamation countersuit filed by the former president against E. Jean Carroll. In May, a jury ordered Trump to pay Carroll $5 million after it found him liable for sexually abusing her at a department store in the 1990s. More than a million homes and businesses lost power Monday as a deadly storm lashed the eastern U.S. from Alabama to New York. At least two people died. Meanwhile, CNN's reporting recent heat waves in the Southwest killed at least 147 people in five counties in Arizona, Nevada, and Texas. Experts believe the actual death toll is far higher. In Baytown, Texas, one couple who'd been married for 52 years died after their air conditioning broke and they couldn't afford to fix it. Extreme weather fueled by the climate crisis continues to devastate communities across the globe. In Slovenia, floods have killed at least six people in what the country's prime minister has described as Slovenia's worst natural disaster. In South Korea, authorities are racing to evacuate nearly 40,000 young people attending the World Scout Jamboree due to an approaching typhoon and extreme heat. The leaders of eight South American nations and thousands of indigenous activists are gathering in the Brazilian city of Belém for a major summit on protecting the Amazon rainforest. Brazil's Minister of the Environment and Climate Change, Marina Silva, spoke ahead of the gathering on Monday.
As we had this 14-year hiatus without a call from the summit, we arrived at it with clarity. The first point is that the Amazon is drastically threatened. The second is that we cannot allow it to enter the point of no return. The third is that it is impossible to reverse this process by working in isolation.
Many indigenous leaders plan to attend the Amazon summit. This is Chief Brownie of the Kayapo people.
If we continue to deforest, we will continue to have problems, not only for indigenous people, but also for all people. We must preserve it so our grandchildren and children can live well, sleep well, eat well, and be happy like us. We, the indigenous peoples, are feeling the climate change. Many rivers are drying up. We are feeling very hot, and the village temperature is very high. The forests are dry. The rivers are drying up because there is a lot of heat and little rain. And this is perceived in the villages and the indigenous communities.
In northern India, more than 300 Muslim homes and businesses have been demolished since Thursday as part of a crackdown led by the ruling Hindu BJP government. On Monday, a court ordered a halt to the demolitions while asking if it was part of an exercise of ethnic cleansing by the state. Al Jazeera reports more than 150 Muslims have also been arrested in what some have described as a campaign of collective punishment following an outbreak of clashes between Hindu and Muslim groups. Britain's begun housing asylum seekers on a large barge off its southern coast in an effort to save money over housing migrants in hotels. This comes despite numerous protests and warnings. Last week, the firefighters' union said the barge was a potential death trap due to a lack of fire exits. There are also reports that the barge has no life jackets. Meanwhile, here in New York City, Mayor Eric Adams has announced a plan to house as many as 2,000 migrants at a tent complex on Randall's Island in the East River. We'll have more on that story later in the broadcast. President Biden's visiting Arizona today, where he's set to formally preserve 1 million acres of land near the Grand Canyon as a new national monument. Environmentalists and Native communities have long pushed for the land to be protected. The move is intended to permanently block uranium mining in the area. In Chicago, police have charged a 43-year-old man with first-degree murder after intentionally shooting a 9-year-old girl in the head while she was riding her scooter. Eyewitnesses said the shooter was upset that the girl, Sarabi Medina, and other kids were making too much noise in front of his home. The gunman, who's been identified as Michael Goodman, is expected in court today. This marks the second time gun violence has shattered the Medina family. In 2018, Sarabi Medina's mother was fatally shot in the head. Police in Montgomery, Alabama, have issued 4 arrest warrants after a group of white boaters attacked a black dock worker who told them to move their illegally parked boat. Cell phone video showed the brawl escalated when a group of men came to defend the dock worker. A 16-year-old who was dubbed Black Aquaman on TikTok, where the video first went viral, was seen swimming across the river to aid the dock worker. And in labor news, over 11,000 city workers in Los Angeles have begun a one-day strike, their first since 1980. The striking workers, including gardeners, custodians, and lifeguards, are represented by SEIU Local 721. Los Angeles has seen a wave of labor organizing this summer. Hollywood writers have been on strike since May, and actors have been on strike since July 14th. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Biden administration has deployed thousands of U.S. Marines and sailors in the Middle East in order to deter Iran from seizing oil tankers and other commercial ships near the Strait of Hormuz. U.S. forces arrived Sunday and could be stationed on interested ships in what the Washington Post called a remarkable escalation of tensions between the two nations. The move comes after the Navy said Iran tried to seize 2 commercial oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman last month and reportedly opened fire on one of the tankers. The U.S. said Iran also seized 2 merchant ships in May and dozens more since 2019. The U.S. Naval Forces Central Command called Iran's actions a, quote, threat to maritime security and the global economy. This is what White House spokesperson John Kirby said on Iran on CNN.
We have seen a real increase now in their attempted attacks or, in some cases, sadly, successful attacks on maritime shipping in and around the Strait of Hormuz, whether it's outside the Gulf or just inside the Gulf. And this is activity that we've seen spike from the Iranians before, certainly spiking now. And we're sending a strong message, not just to Iran, but to our allies and partners, that we take this seriously, because so much, particularly oil, so much of that flows through the Strait of Hormuz. That's a choke point for the Middle East. That has global trade implications. We got to make sure that we can defend our interests and the interests of our allies and partners. That's what these deployments, that's what they're all about.
Meanwhile, Iran has said the ships it detained committed various violations and that at least one ship had issued a distress signal that it was responding to. On Saturday, Iran said it has now equipped its Revolutionary Guards Navy with drones and missiles. This is Iran's Navy commander speaking on state TV.
These missiles can follow multiple targets, accept commands when they are launched, and change their target along the way.
For more, we're joined in Washington, D.C. by Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, author of several books, including Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. His current column for Responsible Statecraft is headlined, "With Marines on Persian Gulf Vessels, Is Biden Risking War with Iran?" Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Trita. Well, maybe you can answer that question for us. Lay out what led to what the U.S. is doing and how Iran is responding and what you're so concerned about.
Well, this is extremely concerning, and there's a reason why the Washington Post characterized this latest potential move by the Biden administration as a remarkable escalation. It is because it is a remarkable escalation, and that does risk leading the two countries into war. The Iranians taking some of these ships in the Gulf of Oman and the Persian Gulf is without a doubt a problem that needs to be addressed. But the root of this problem is that the Biden administration has continued Trump's maximum pressure strategy on Iran and has been confiscating vessels with Iranian oil, saying that this is the implementation of U.S. sanctions. But U.S. sanctions and U.S. laws do not apply to international waters. And as a result, the maritime security of the Persian Gulf has been threatened by these actions and by the response of the Iranians. If we truly want this to end, the easiest way is to stop confiscating the Iranian oil. And that way, there will be no reason for the Iranians to do what they have been doing. And they have not been doing this unless there has been any measures by the U.S. In this direction. But by putting these Marines on commercial vessels, this has not happened since the previous century during the world wars, and that was during wartime. So that is a reason as to why the Washington Post is characterizing this as a remarkable escalation.
The Washington Post also reports other recent steps to deter Iran include the deployment of advanced F-35 jets, along with other fighter aircraft and an A-10 attack jets to the Persian Gulf region. Your response?
Yeah, what we're seeing here, which is quite concerning, is that despite all of the promises that there would be lesser U.S. military presence in the Persian Gulf and in the Middle East, bringing the troops home, we're now seeing the Biden administration moving more troops into the region, betting on deterrence rather than actually a de-escalation of the situation. And part of the reason why the administration is doing this is because of its key priority in the Middle East right now, which is to get Saudi Arabia to normalize relations with Israel. In order to do so, the Saudis have asked for a defense pact with the United States, something that Biden so far has been reluctant to offer, because it would mean that the United States would have to sacrifice its servicemen and women for the defense of the Saudi dictatorship. But in order to meet them halfway, it appears that the administration is calculating that by moving more troops to the region, by demonstrating that it is willing to go into conflict with Iran, that that will make the Saudis more comfortable that the United States will come to their defense, even in the absence of an official security pact. And the question we have to ask ourselves, all of this for what? Because getting the Saudis to normalize relations with Israel at a time when the Israelis have the most extremist government in their entire history, the annexation of Palestinian territory, the impossibility of actually making peace between Israel and Palestinians because of the policies of the Israeli government currently, to have that normalization take place in that context, it would be an American endorsement of what the Israeli government currently is doing in terms of undermining any prospect for peace. So it's really baffling to see why we're taking such immense risks that could bring the U.S. into war for achieving things that are of little value when it comes to peace and stability in the region or U.S. interest in the region.
Trita Parsi, you also have the potential for the Iranians to use a water drone to take out a tanker, the significance of American soldiers potentially drifting into Iranian waters, what all this could mean.
Yes, one scenario that I'm not sure the White House has taken fully into account is, instead of the Iranians going after some of these commercial vessels in the manner that they have done so far, they may use a drone to take out the engine and then let the ship drift into Iranian waters. At that point, you would have 20 or so U.S. Marines in Iranian waters. The Iranians would confiscate those ships, probably deter the American soldiers. And that would be probably the biggest crisis that the Biden administration has faced. You know, this did happen by accident in 2016 when some American sailors accidentally veered into Iranian waters because of navigation and engine problems. That was resolved in 16 hours because the JCPOA was in place, because the Obama administration had established a good channel of communication with the Iranians. And as a result, most Americans don't even know about this because it was resolved so quickly. Biden has done none of this. And as a result, if this scenario were to take place, it would lead to a major crisis and a potential point of military confrontation between the two countries.
You write, it is impressive how MBS, Mohammed bin Sultan, the head of Saudi Arabia, essentially, it is impressive how MBS has played Biden. Explain.
Well, if you take a look at what's happening during the Biden administration, Biden came in promising that he's going to show the world the pariah that Saudi Arabia is. He's going to take a tougher stance, that he's going to end the war in Yemen. Many, many different promises that were made. But instead, we've seen the MBS, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, play tough ball with the Biden administration, raise oil prices at a moment that was really crucial to the U.S. for prices to go down, push back really hard, make a deal with the Iranians through the Chinese. All of these different measures, and all we've seen from the Biden administration is to pursue a softer and softer approach towards Saudi Arabia, including now even considering some form of a security arrangement with the Saudis in return for this normalization. It seems to me that this obsession of getting a Saudi-Israeli normalization, which again has questionable value, is the leading star of the administration. And as a result, they're willing to go to great lengths and great concessions to Saudi Arabia in order to achieve this. And it's not even clear whether MBS is really going to go for it at the end of the day. The just dangling of that opportunity is getting him massive concessions from the U.S. side.
We're coming up on the first anniversary of the protest for justice for Mahsa Amini, the young Kurdish Iranian woman who died at the hands of the so-called morality police, her death sparking massive protests, not only in Iran, but around the world. Do you think U.S. antagonism towards Iran will actually embolden Iranian leaders to be more violent and impressive, as we understand they are preparing for a new crackdown on the people?
I think in the larger context, greater tensions between the United States and Iran have been to the detriment of the pro-democracy movement in Iran. Their ability to be able to pursue the changes that they are seeking is all the more difficult when there's high tensions between the two countries. But in this specific instance, in the short tactical term, I doubt that the impact is going to be particularly significant. The government there has been extremely brutal in its clampdown of protesters. Even though I think that there's a likelihood that there will be new protests taking place on the anniversary, because the anger of the population is still there, there's been nothing that has really systematically changed in the country in terms of addressing some of the root causes of this. Nevertheless, the repression is likely going to be very intense. And if you take a look at this over the longer term, what we have seen is that when countries are under the type of broad-based economic sanctions that Iran is under, and countries like Cuba, Venezuela, Zimbabwe, and others have been under, the long-term effect is that the governments tend to become far more repressive than they were before. Because in order to keep control and stay in power and control the anger of the population, they resort to more and more repression. And the instances in which we have in which these type of broad-based sanctions eventually lead to democratization are essentially very few. There's only one example. It's South Africa. In all other cases, these type of broad-based sanctions have actually led to a situation in which the population is more repressed because the government becomes more repressive, more aggressive, including more aggressive on the foreign policy arena as well.
We just have 30 seconds, Trita, but what do you think should happen now as Biden makes this move? I mean, he was Obama's vice president, but do you think his policy on Iran, despite what he said leading up to the election, is more like Trump's?
Well, in certain aspects, you know, he is continuing the maximum pressure strategy. I think the administration did try diplomacy with Iran in negotiations, and certainly the Iranians have created a massive amount of problems in that process. But I think there was a key mistake the administration did in the beginning, which was it didn't go back into the agreement right away through an executive order, as it did, for instance, with the Paris Agreement, with WTO. Instead, it chose a negotiated path, and it used the Trump sanctions as leverage for that. And I think that has been a critical mistake that has led to several consequences, including the ones that we're seeing right now.
Trita Parsi, I want to thank you for being with us. Executive Vice President, Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. We'll link to your column with Marines on Persian Gulf vessels. Is Biden risking war with Iran? Next up, an update on the U.S. response to asylum seekers from the southern border in Texas, where state troopers are separating migrant families to New York City. Stay with us. By the Iranian-American musician Maral. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Texas, where the Republican governor, Greg Abbott, is escalating his crackdown on asylum seekers at the southern border. The Houston Chronicle reports Texas troopers recently changed their policy and are now separating migrant families at the U.S.-Mexico border under Abbott's Operation Lone Star. At least two dozen families have been separated. The policy has been widely condemned by immigrant rights advocates for its abuses. Attorneys with Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid say most of the separated families, separating the mother and children from the fathers, are from Venezuela and plan to turn themselves in to U.S. border officials to request asylum. Instead, state troopers with the Texas Department of Public Safety arrest the fathers on trespassing charges. Other family members, including their young children, were separately detained by Border Patrol. The practice violates the Abbott administration's own border enforcement guidelines. Advocates are calling on the Biden administration to intervene and immediately reunite the families. The campaign, hashtag Welcome with Dignity, said in a statement, quote, "The world can now see that Governor Abbott's cruelty knows no bounds," unquote. Just last month, Biden's Justice Department sued Governor Abbott after Texas installed barrels wrapped in razor wire in the Rio Grande to block asylum seekers from crossing the river. Dozens of migrants, including children, have suffered severe injuries and lacerations after being cut by razor wire. Last week, the body of two asylum seekers were found in the Rio Grande, one of them trapped in the razor wire barrier. The first reported deaths linked to the boys include a victim identified as a 20-year-old from Honduras. Meanwhile, the blistering heat wave in Texas has also been deadly for migrants crossing through the region, with a whistleblower recently revealing Texas border officials were ordered to deny migrants drinking water, even in the brutal heat. For more, we go to El Paso, Texas, where we're joined by Marisa Limon Garza, executive director of Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, though not under these circumstances. Marisa, can you describe what you understand is happening at the border? People might say they thought under Trump they understood the separation policy, still dealing with perhaps 1,000 families that have never been reunited. But it's continuing to happen?
Indeed, it does seem like it's continuing to happen here at our southern border. We believe in the safety and well-being of all people, and that's an understanding that is shared by many Americans. And we know, we all know, including Governor Abbott, the incredible harms and lifelong damage that is caused by this kind of separation. We know what happens to children, the psychological damage to adults as well. And it's not surprising, unfortunately, that he has continued to ratchet up the response in many measures to gain political points. And so we see this separation occurring, we see the harms that it causes, and it's incredibly difficult to continue to have that happen here at our southern border. When you pair that with the horrors of this buoy system and everything that we're seeing in Eagle Pass with razor wire and the lacerations on people and the harm that that causes, it just goes back to a tired trope that people continue to try to pursue, which is a deterrence practiced through cruelty. And this cruelty continues to be augmented and built upon in horrific ways that we know are just not effective. People are on the move across the globe. This has not deterred migrants from coming. If anything, these practices put people into more harm's way when they're just trying to seek asylum, you know, their legal right. And so it's horrific to see, and we call on the Biden administration to continue